Welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lelchuk. We hope you'll subscribe and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Now, if you like the show, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. We believe now more than ever in providing a platform for individuality, free thought, and a diverse range of views. By supporting the show this way, you'll get early access to episodes, bonus episodes, and much, much more. Remember, the conversation is always active at Talking Beats Podcast on social media. Here's Daniel Lelchuk.
On today's program, cable news political star, commentator, and host Chris Matthews. From 1997 until 2020, he hosted the legendary weeknight political show Hardball with Chris Matthews, where he held politicians' feet to the fire and asked them the tough, hard questions. He's the author of a number of best-selling books, including Hardball, How Politics is Played, Told by One Who Knows the Game, Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit, and just out now, This Country, My Life in Politics and History. Prior to broadcasting and writing books, he was speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter and the top aide to the longtime Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, Tip O'Neill. Finding someone with more knowledge and passion for U.S. politics is a tall order, and I'm thrilled the legendary Chris Matthews is right here with me. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Just before we get started, I met you twice. Once was in Rome. I went to part of high school in Rome, and 2005 April, the Pope dies, and you come over to cover it, and I get a nice picture with you pre-selfies and pre-cell phones right there in St. Peter's Square. That was the second time. First time was 1999. Al Gore, Bill Bradley are having a debate in that quintessential Ivy League college town, Hanover, New Hampshire. You come to do Hardball on Murphy's on the Green, Irish pub. Probably you remember that place. You've been there a lot in Hanover. And I go up to you after it finishes. I'm 10 years old. And I say, hey, I was passionate about politics, not because I knew anything. Just I love the glitz. I love the drama. I love the fast pace. I said, hey, Chris, who are you for? You said, guess. I said, oh, shit, what do I say? McCain. And you burst out laughing. You put your hand on my shoulder. You go, you're way off, kid.
Yeah, well, I was trying to avoid committing myself in public. Let's see. I was rooting quietly for John McCain, I think. I was also rooting for Bradley a bit because he was new. And my daughter was great. She was waiting. I always took one of my kids to New Hampshire with me for the primary every 4 years. And it was her turn, Caroline. And she's so smart and so precocious. She said, you know the difference between George W. Bush and Bill Bradley? And I said, I don't know. And she said, Bradley has something to say.
Mm. Mm.
So she was very thoughtful. She was, of course, she went on to get 3 Ivy League degrees, but she's something.
Well,
I love the primaries. I love the primaries because it's all you tremendous access to the candidates. You can go. It's like going to a resort. You go to one speech after another, and you were there. You must have been at Dartmouth. Dartmouth's a great town. I was up there again this past year for the primary.
Yeah, I was. I was 10 at the time, so I wasn't quite college age yet, but I was, I guess, middle school. That is, but super passionate about the whole thing, and I loved Hardball from when I was a really young kid. But talk about your falling in love with politics, because you have a passion for it that few, if any, do. I mean, a real passion like I do for music, where I can't go a day without it. What's that all about?
I guess the human competition. The drama of losing, you put yourself out there totally and you ask people to like you. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, people say that's simple-minded, but you vote for the person you like. And you may have a couple of reasons for doing that, party, ideology. But oftentimes, who do you really root for? Somebody you like. I mean, I think most people are more like me than true ideologues. And they lose sometimes. In fact, half the time they lose. In fact, most of the time, one person wins, and a whole number of people who ran in that election, primaries especially, lost. And when they lose, they have to go before their public, their people, their workers, and say, I lost. And oftentimes there are tears involved. They cry in the back room, if not on the stage. It's very personal. I know this from experience, how personal it is with people. And how many people in life, as Kennedy says, Jack Kennedy said in Profiles in Courage, the first chapter, he says, how many careers do you have to stick your neck out like that for public approval? And that's why I guess why I like it. I like class. I like people that show courage. I like people that show magnanimity when they lose and say something nice about the other person. I'm a softie when it comes to that. If I hear a candidate say something good about his opponent, I'm overwhelmed. I watched Mitt Romney at the Al Smith Dinner in New York. That's a dinner held by the Archdiocese of New York, the Catholic Archdiocese. And it's always a night to show some self-deprecation and some class towards your opponent. And I remember Mitt Romney, who was in a very close contest with President Obama, talking about Obama's family and what a great family it was and how it was a family that any man would be proud of. And it may be a little bit patriarchal the way he said it, but I thought it showed something that Mitt continues to show. He's a gentleman, and he has his own integrity. He has integrity. And that's what I'm looking for in politics. Somebody to root for in life. A champion. Winston Churchill. Franklin Roosevelt. Abraham Lincoln. I want to have somebody to root for. Because I'm not running myself. I want a champion.
What about all those people when W was running who didn't really agree with his politics when he was running the first time? But they said, you know, but he'd be great to have a beer with. I mean, that's sort of what you're talking about. I'd love to have a beer with him. That's what I'm going to vote
well,
for.
Well, maybe you're right. I remember John Kerry, who is a friend of mine, doesn't have that gift. Formality can get between you and the public. There's no doubt about it. Formality. And that's just men and women. Both, maybe more with women, because women are very professional. And men tend to be a little more casual in politics because they're more used to it, perhaps generation-wise. But I remember I did a set where I did two clips. One was John Kerry coming into a dinette and catching a woman who's sitting in a banquette all by herself reading a paperback. She obviously has a tough job. She's glad to take the hour off. The noon hour off, and she's sitting there with a paperback just trying to get away from work, you know, mentally. You know what's going on here. And John came over and loomed over her and read his five-point plan for something or other, economics. I go, my God, that woman, she just wants to be alone. She wants to have this treasured time at none. And then I saw another scene where W walked into a dinette, and he sees a family with three kids, young family, and one's a boy. And the first thing he does, he says, hey, dude, what's it like to be the only boy in the family? What's that like? I mean, one had the ability to connect and one doesn't. And maybe because one, I don't know what favor W was born with, obviously the silver spoon, but somehow he developed that frat boys or whatever. I knew a guy who was a brother of a friend of mine, got a call from, how'd you like to, hey, buddy, how'd you like to, we went to business school. Well, how'd you like to be my ambassador to Morocco? Come on. Yeah. I mean, who wouldn't like having that guy for a classmate? He calls you up and says you want to be an ambassador, you know, because, I mean, the casualness of it, of course, the deadly part of that casualness, he would spend 15 minutes looking at appeals for commutation to death sentences down in Texas, you know, that didn't go too well with him. So personality, yeah, it does matter. And should it be the decisive force? Well, in a close election, it will be. I think that's how we're lost to W. And it's how they have another, it's how Jack Kennedy beat Nixon that way. When it's close call, you go with somebody you like, probably, I would bet.
Talk a little bit about your background, politics and media, you know, journalism, all these different places, and working in politics, making a run yourself. I mean, this whole world about writing, being on the inside, the outside, and you've been on both. I guess that's what made you so successful as a journalist and reporter, that you had sort of half your body right on the inside.
And also half my body looking at it from a distance, an outsider.
Yeah.
So I don't think I've ever lost my outsider's attitude towards government and what goes on there. And I hope I got that in my book. What I would think of if I just heard about something, how would I be aghast at it, or would I be accepting of it? I, I do think of myself as an outsider, but I managed to get on the inside and I managed to see how it works. But I was still appalled at things I saw. Some of the shenanigans the Democrats pulled over spending and how they were covering up their big spending, or how that one time I remember writing about they didn't want to have a cost of living adjustment for minimum wage. They didn't want it to go up with productivity or with the prices, with inflation, because they wanted to get credit for every time they raised it. Isn't that amazing? That's how politics is. We don't want it automatic. We want credit for it every time. And that's what they did to Social Security. And a lot of them resented that because they made Wilbur Mills back in the 70s, I guess, made Social Security as the campaign. He was running for president, believe it or not. He's drunk, I guess, but he was running for president. And he made Social Security automatic, the cost of living adjustments every 2 years. Of course, seniors enjoy that. But the politicians would have much preferred to have the old system where every once in a while they would raise the Social Security benefits to make up inflation. And they got credit for it. Personal credit every time they did it. So,
well, you know,
so sometimes politics is logical, but it doesn't look very good.
You know, speaking of logical, you know, I think that's a word that's sorely missing. I mean, I'm a amateur political watcher, but I'm passionate about politics, and I'm a millennial, and I, you know, look back and I read books. I read your book, which, by the way, is This Country, My Life in Politics and History. It's a beautiful homage to this country, but it's not all. Warm and cuddly. There's a lot of challenges that you put out to the public in a way and to yourself. But if you look back, not even that long ago, 30, 40 years, and you look now, it's really remarkable, the lack of logic, the lack of to use a word that you use, comedy with a T. What's happening? I mean, when you were there with Tip O'Neill and, you know, this whole thing.
Okay, let me give you the short one on this because it's a great
question. Give a long one. Give a long one if you want.
Well, I'll give you an idea. I think when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, I thought the two-party system made a lot of sense because in Pennsylvania, where I grew up in Philadelphia, the Republicans would be called in when the Democrats blew it, when they had a corrupt whatever, or somebody they didn't like the smell of or something, whatever it was, they brought the Republicans in as the relief pitchers. And they would be in for a while, and then the Democrats would come back in again when the Republicans blew it. But you always had an alternative. You could say, and the other side would keep the inside crowd honest. They would catch him often in the role of district attorney. In fact, a lot of people got to be governor by being district attorneys in places like New York and other states where they were able to, like Tom Dewey, where they made their names bringing down corruption in Democratic Party power. But lately, the politicians in both parties do not use their alternative ability to pose themselves as alternatives. They try to undercut the other side's successes. Like, in other words, instead of trying to catch them at corruption, they catch them at doing good stuff. They don't want them to pass anything that might be popular. So they want to make sure the other side never gets anything done that's any good. I mean, Ted Kennedy was good. Nixon tried to fix health care. He wouldn't let him do it. He didn't want to get credit for it. We could have gotten all this done years ahead of Obama on health care. Nixon was going to have an employer mandate where every employer had to give his employees, her employees, health care. Come on. Imagine that if he'd had that back in the 70s. And we could have. Kennedy undercut it. And he said later he felt guilty about it. We should have, because he did want health care for the people. But right now, I think if you see the Democrats trying to do infrastructure, why wouldn't a Republican want to help them do it? It's a good thing to do. Republicans, I remember Pennsylvania Republican members of Congress always loving Pork Barrel. You want stuff fixed in your district. You want the bridge fixed. Why don't you want to have real, legitimate, really efficiently spent money on fixing up civic property, bridges, tunnels, roads, whatever, maybe state-of-the-art rapid rail even? Why wouldn't you want that? Because you know it's popular. So right now, I think the Republican Party is stopping the Democrats from doing something even Democrats, even Republicans believe in. That's what's horrible about politics today. Nobody wants anybody to look good.
Who was it that you told a story before that looked up all of the bridges that had cracks?
I did that.
Okay. And what's that all about?
Well, the Republican leader was Bob Michael of a friend of the speakers of Tibbs. And he was on the floor roaring away at the evils of some Democratic big spending jobs bill. So I called up the chief engineer of Peoria, Illinois, his hometown, his major city, and got from him the list of all, list the names of all the bridges below safety code in his district. And the speaker liked it. Even though he liked Bob Michael, he grabbed the list, went down the floor of the house, left the speaker's chair, went down the floor and read that list to the entire country of all the dangerous bridges in Bob Michael's district. At which point Bob, red faced, ran to the back of the room looking for his press secretary, friend of mine. And I obviously had to put out the fire back home that was burning already. So I think that kind of, I relish that kind of politics. I wish more Democrats today, staffers and members, knew how to do it. You take the fire to the enemy, you make them defend their position opposing infrastructure in this case. You don't just play, gee whiz, can't we spend some more money? No, why don't you say, how come, buddy, don't want to keep, you want to defend those rickety bridges in your district that school buses have to go over. You make them play defense. I mean, I think that's good, clean politics.
But that's totally logical. But you wonder if at this point, let's say, you know, God forbid, let's just say a bridge collapses middle of the night, no one's on it. But a bridge collapses in, I don't know, somewhere in the
West Virginia.
Okay, I was going to say Oklahoma. Sure, West Virginia. Okay, more interesting for a few reasons. And no one's hurt. Okay, that's great. But the bridge is gone. Would Republicans then say, "Oh yeah, maybe we got to repair this"? Or would they still say, "Screw it"?
That's the $64,000 question. Are people in politics amenable, available for logic anymore? Are they willing to say, all politics is local, I got to represent my district, I need some help in infrastructure, it's falling apart? You know, I've been around the world. You know the differences between a first world country and a third world country? You fix stuff up. You paint stuff. You rebuild it when it's falling apart. You put some money into civic property. And everything keeps getting better. 2 weeks ago in Beverly Hills, it's beautiful. Everything is up. So now that's a wealthy community. But keeping things up, rebuilding, the smell of construction, people love it. Rebuild, fix, paint, make it look good. Poor countries can't do that. They spend all their money on subsistence, just paying people to work or just to keep alive. I mean, I've always wondered, I can see they don't have the money to do it, but countries with wealth tend to rebuild and keep things good looking and looking and working well. That's what they do. That's what a modern country looks like. I'm sure that's what it's like in the Northern European countries and all of Europe, really. The country, you make things, you keep stuff up. Like anybody owns a house, you keep painting it every 7 years. You do what needs to be done, the brickwork, the roof, whatever. You keep things up, the plumbing. You keep things up. Are we going to do that as a country or not? Are we going to let things fall apart? I wonder. I think we could probably spend $1 trillion rebuilding the New York sewer system or the New York water system or the electrical system underground or the subways. Oh my God, this stuff that went done was built in the 20s and the 30s and even in some cases in the 19th century, it's still there. It's still underground down there. Who knows? I remember seeing how vulnerable this was during 9/11 when they were rebuilding, you know, the seawall down at the bottom of the Battery in New York City. And all that stuff was so old and decrepit. Are we going to do something about it or not? I don't know. Well, it's also a good way to get the economy rolling.
Isn't it a little bit like gun control in a way where we think, oh, that shooting is going to be the tipping point, and it never is?
Well, that's certainly true. I thought when Bobby Kennedy got shot, I wrote my congressman, Johnny Carson, who was totally non-political, went on television and said, I don't do this, but write your congressman about gun control. Because he was living in the same building as Bobby Kennedy in New York, UN Plaza. And yeah, you're right. It never seems to do it, does it? No.
Or after Sandy Hook, people said, well, this will be the one. This will be the one. Nothing changed, right?
Well, that's because, well, it's the Second Amendment, and it's which is there, inconveniently for some people, but it's there. The right to bear arms, it says that. Because we need militias. I don't know if that was connected or not. Depends on what court we have at the time. But that's a problem of politics. So the average liberal, for example, progressive is the term today, cares about gun control. Is probably pro-immigrant, probably tough on police, need for reform. They've got a lot of issues. They certainly are big on climate. So they've got a whole passel of issues they care about. And one of them is gun control. The Second Amendment voter has one issue. I have a brother like this. They have one vote and one issue, and they are one vote. They were single issue voters, and they will vote against any gun control candidate because that's all they focus on. And that shows power. And that's where the NRA is able to raise money and be a strong organization, because people who have their guns vote on that issue alone. People that don't have guns, don't like guns, vote on a lot of things.
So is the Second Amendment more powerful than abortion? Is it even more powerful than the single voter abortion person out there?
Well, on both sides of the abortion issue, I think there are single voters, single issue voters. That's a great question. I would say in Pennsylvania, where I grew up, it's still pretty safe to be pro-gun and anti-abortion rights, anti-abortion rights. I think so. Bobby Casey will be there forever. Yeah, Bobby Casey's pro-life and pro-gun. And Toomey's pro-gun and pro-life. I guess that tells you something. They're senators for life, basically, if Toomey wanted to stay.
Let me ask you a personal question. And it's not about you know, why you left MSNBC, because that's been, you know, rehashed everywhere. People can go look it up or whatever. But it's about... when you left, it was at this right at about a week before the national lockdown started and the pandemic was really coming in full swing. It was early March 2020. The presidential race was getting super volatile. And suddenly you, the beacon of millions of people look to for political guidance and intuition, you were gone. Were you just pulling your hair out? Shit, what the hell? I mean, you had so much to say, and then you were gone. What was that like? It's such a pivotal, bizarre period in spring 2020.
Well, it was a stunning event for me, of course, and I was down in covering the race for the Democratic nomination, and I thought it was going in one direction when I left, and quickly changed in a matter of hours, really. I saw Biden winning, coming in fourth in Iowa in the caucuses, coming in fifth in New Hampshire. In Nevada, by God, that afternoon, I thought nobody got any votes but Bernie. At one point in the afternoon, it looked like nobody on the other side, anybody else was getting a vote except Bernie. And then Biden got a 19 points. So he was in the running, but he was still in running. And I guess something happened over that weekend besides me leaving, which was that the moderates seemed to coalesce around Biden. And the left, the progressive left, I think realized, for what I still hold, maybe I'm a romantic, I think there were a number of progressives that said, yes, I'm a progressive, but we have to win this election against Trump, and Biden's the guy that can do it. I think if you go through the numbers, that's what you'll see. It wasn't just that they got outnumbered by the moderates, but they made a different calculation. They decided they wanted to win. And of course, that's what happened. What's your instrument?
Cello. I'm a cellist.
What do you call when there's four guys together? It's called...
string quartet.
No, there's the other word for it. Chamber music.
Oh, yeah, chamber music. Yeah, chamber music is anything from two all on up to, I don't know, 8 or 10 people.
Yeah, I had a roommate in grad school who was from Iowa, and he was into that. And Latakia Tobacco and that. but I played I had the cornet and the French horn in high school, which I was not able to play, but I carried it rather efficiently. Well, there was a lot of marching bands in Philadelphia that in high school that some musicians a lot of walk but I did take piano for a number of years. It's on my bucket list to get back at it and start.
Well, you know where I am right now is I'm in Rappahannock County, Virginia, which is 70 miles south.
Oh, it's so pretty. Yeah,
it's amazing there. And the great conductor died a few years ago. Lauren Mazel built an incredible theater out here on its 800-acre farm. And so we have a chamber series, speaking of chamber music, that we've been having here for years, probably 7-8 years now. So I'm here a few times a year, and we did recordings during COVID, and now we've had live concerts in April and more live concerts right now. There's a, you know, convenient truth and an inconvenient truth, right, in life and in politics. I mean, how do you as a member of the media, you know, balance what, oh, that's a great narrative, but wait a minute, the other thing may be a little more true?
Well, I wrote a book, Kennedy and Nixon, my best book maybe, and because it's about their personal friendship for years before they ran against each other, which everyone else seems to have pushed aside. It's an inconvenient fact that they were friends, but they were. And known to be. That's the part that's interesting, that they were known to be friends. For example, my boss, Tip O'Neill, was very friendly with George Herbert Walker Bush. Very friendly. He liked the guy, you know? He didn't have that relationship with Dukakis, but he supported him publicly. George Herbert Walker Bush was good friends with Ross Dinkowski. Even when he went to prison, they stayed together in contact. That's true. I mean, there are these relationships that people have, and they cover them up. I guess there are hostilities too. They cover up. But it's a very closed business. You know, how many businesses where everybody in the United States Congress all comes into the same room together many times a day, the same room. They walk the same hallways together, the exact same hallways, eating the same lunchroom together, the dining room together. They're physically around each other all the time. Nobody wrote about that until I wrote Kennedy and Nixon, because I wanted to capture that closeness of life. Kennedy and Nixon had their office across from each other for 8 years before they ran for president against each other, right across the hall in the Senate building. And they saw each other all the time. They were comparing which books they're reading and everything, and going to the same parties together, and very strange. And then all of a sudden they got on the stage together and those four debates, the great debates, and Kennedy acted like he never met Nixon before. And I think it really flustered Nixon. It chilled him. It did not make him, it chilled the wrong word. It froze him. He was not able to deal with that.
And they were his friends as in real social, I have a drink together, get a steak dinner.
Well, they were, it started, they had their first debate in 1947 in Pennsylvania. They took the train. They took the train back that night. One was on the top bunk. Kennedy was on the top bunk. Nixon was on the bottom bunk, all the way back to D.C. Then they spent the whole train ride talking about the Cold War coming up, the arriving Cold War in 1947. Yeah, I've got, you know, the letters back and forth are amazing. And Kennedy thought of Nixon as sort of like the top jock on campus. Nixon was the superstar. He's vice president by the time he's like in his 30s. Kennedy never thought he could catch up to the guy until 1956. Then he realized he could run for president. He could take on Nixon in 60. And that's when they really diverged, when they both realized they're going to be running against each other. Great story.
Chris Matthews, why did you join the Peace Corps? I'm just curious. I mean, you write a lot.
I wanted to do something. The draft was out there. You had to do something. I was either going to become a public information officer in the Army. I thought that would help me learn to write. Al Gore did that. I thought about VISTA. I thought about teaching high school, the National Health Service. There was all kinds of options. I was not. I just said to myself, I wasn't going to put on a uniform and act like I was in the war, like Navy or Air Force or something like that. I wanted to. There are ways that you could serve very brilliantly and look good and everything, but you're not going into combat. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something positive, and the Peace Corps was an alternative service. In fact, when I got in, after turning down a couple of assignments, I got the assignment I wanted, which is economic development in Africa. We got a letter from the Peace Corps saying, if you have any draft problems, let us know. We'll help you with them. I thought it was a great opportunity. I mean, to go over to Africa and spend 2 years working with African people, business guys, and working with the Ministry of Commerce, working for the Minister of Commerce, Simon Mumalo. I mean, as a trade development advisor, you had a great title. I hitchhiked all the way through East Africa by myself, just with my thumb, all the way from Swaziland all the way up to Kilimanjaro. I got used to going to Mozambique on weekends. It sounds exotic beyond belief, and it was the way I got to live for 2 years plus. And then I went to Israel for a month and hung around England for a while and came home and started knocking on doors looking for a job in politics. It's pretty magical.
It's pretty magical. And you bring that, you know, in music, I always think about, and the great conductor, you probably know this name, Toscanini, who conducted the NBC. Sure. Yeah, he always talked about that what you bring to music is not just your technical skill and your musical knowledge, but it's your whole life tapestry woven together that comes to bear when you come on stage or you come on a rehearsal. And it sounds like it's that way with you, that you're not sure exactly maybe what you got in Israel or what you got in England, but it's deep inside, buried in your DNA, and it travels with you the rest of your life.
That's in Tennyson, about what I've been through, I carry with me. Yeah. Tennyson's Ulysses. Ted Kennedy was always quoting that. I think Jack too. I don't know. I think it's interesting thing how music does intertwine. I remember Ayn Rand was always talking about Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto. You know, do you ever read that? The Shrug?
Yeah, I never have.
Well, you don't have to, but I'll just give the short answer. Somehow she identified the romance of the id, of the fountainhead, basically, the human individual, and the possibilities, romantic possibilities, really. And with Rachmaninoff's second, and I used to listen to it all the time. I had like a tape recording of it. It was so inspiring. I don't know, but I think Rachmaninoff is my fave. And he's the one.
Really?
Yeah.
You listen to a lot of music. You took piano as a kid.
Yeah, I listened to the symphony on XM radio on Sirius. Come on, how can you not? Best deal in history. It's the greatest deal. And Martin Goldsmith. Come on. I wrote my first book, Hardball, to the soundtrack of Out of Africa, which is I believe John Barry, because he did everything. And then John Barry write all the great. All the great scores. I think he did.
Well, and John Williams wrote some pretty good ones too.
He sure did. And Bernard, what's his name? Bernard, his name in a minute. They did a lot of the other stuff. They did all the Hitchcock movies.
The old guy. Yeah. Bernard Herrmann.
Exactly. You know, the great story about him, he and Hitchcock had been great partners. Of course, with Psycho, the music is eerie beyond belief and frightening. And North by Northwest, gorgeous score. So he did one of his late ones. He did something for Torn Curtain, which was a classic Hitchcock romantic couple, very attractive, Paul Newman and Julie Andrews. And they're behind the Iron Curtain for something or other. And so he writes the score for it. And Hitchcock turned it down out of nowhere. He didn't like it. The movie never started. It never made it. Anything. It never happened because it didn't have Herman's score. Isn't that something?
Wow.
And then, wow. Did Hitchcock learn his lesson the hard way? I need the music. And I always say to people, name a great movie or any movie you like that didn't have a great score. Just name anyone from Gone with the Wind on. Name any movie Lawrence of Arabia. Name any great movie that didn't have a unique, unique, memorable score. You know, Treasure of Sierra Madre, A Bridge Too Far, Red River. They're all amazingly great music. And I know a lot of it's derived, but I don't know enough to know that. But it's impossible. Just think of any movie without a great score.
It's very true. And the music in Casablanca, David, to talk about great music.
Time goes by. Impossible to imagine without it. And I think a lot of it... I always wonder how a composer gets the job and they tell, here's a movie, we're going to show you the movie, rough cut. Give us some music to these scenes. Give us the, they call it incidental music. It must be amazing for these composers to be told at a meeting, and here's the rough cut of the movie. We want some music to go to this. Incidental, we want the big score. And they think they give different themes to different characters sometimes.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. That's straight out of Wagner opera where you hear this, you know, it's called a leitmotif, where it's one little musical snippet and you're like, oh, that's Wotan. That's his little music.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah. And I thought it was, you know, I think of movies like Notting Hill even. I mean, how can you see that movie without listening to Elvis Costello singing She, you know? The music is essential to that movie.
Look, Chris Matthews, a lot of people loved you because you asked the questions that they wanted to ask. They were sitting on the couch, you know, with a bag of chips and a beer saying, come on, Chris, ask it. You know, okay. And you did that. So I want to do that to you. And I'm going to ask a question I haven't heard people ask you directly enough. will you be back? When are you going to be back? People want you back.
I'm serious.
This
job. I know. I'm a distinguished professor of American politics and media in Ho Chi Minh City at the Fulbright University of Vietnam. That's what I'm doing. I'm finishing this book. I'm going to keep writing articles and probably more books if this one get going here. I don't really want to talk about it. I don't have any plans. I'd like the invitations. I was on, oh my God, a whole handful of shows on MSNBC recently to promote the book, and Steve Colbert and Bill Maher. I love doing it all. I'm very grateful for all those people to invite me on to talk about the book.
But, and me.
And here we are. And you can obviously hear the absence of a response to your question. But my wife, I'm 75 years old, believe it or not. I mean that, believe it or not. And my wife keeps reminding me of that.
Yeah, but
I don't know what to say. I do. I have in my head that I want to get involved in a really good campaign of some kind. I don't know what it is. A campaign is the right word, but I mean it in a broader sense than that. Something to do something. I don't know what it is. I'm not finished doing something. I have an office I rent on Connecticut Avenue in D.C. I have all my paintings in there and my stuff. And I'm capable of producing out of that office. So let's see what I can do. But I have no plans for television. None. I always wanted to be Eric Severide. But, I think I did that. And he retired at 65. You had to retire in those days. CBS just pushed you out the door. Cronkite was pushed out at 65.
But that was then. This is now. They want to be hearing you more than, every few years when you have a book out. They really do. I do.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
I mean,
what do you want me to say? What is the answer to this question?
I don't know.
I appreciate your support and your liking of my thought process. And I know that there's only one way to get to all the people, and that's TV or radio. But even radio doesn't quite do it because there's really no national radio audience.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think Sirius XM has an audience anything like in the millions.
No.
I mean, I was probably 5 million people a week watch this, a couple times a week. Do the math. People keep bumping into me. I really am affected by it. I have people come up to me and say, "Miss you, I wish you were back on. When are you coming back?" And I guess I act that way. I guess I act like I want to come back on. So, but I'm glad they miss me. I miss them. As I said, imitating the great Victor Borge. Remember him?
Yeah, he was funny. Yeah.
Well, he was funny. His story. He was Jewish and he was Danish, and he may have been married to an American, but he was on Hitler's list for two reasons: ethnicity, religion, and also he made a career out of making fun of Hitler. That's what he did in nightclub acts in Europe.
Yeah.
And so he escaped through somehow got to the United States, and his first year in the United States, he was a regular on the Bing Crosby radio show. First year. Within 5 years, he had his own show on NBC Radio. This is America.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated with the guy.
Yeah.
Victor Borge. I think it's Morgenstern or something. It's his name. Morgenstern, something like that. It's his real name. And I thought, look at this guy's life and what he was facing. The Holocaust, and he comes over to here, and he builds his whole career. Who could be more American than Victor Borge? And we loved him as kids. Loved
them. Let me close out, but I just want to read a little quote that you put in the end of the book. It's a quote from Adlai Stevenson, and the quote is: "When an American says he loves his country, he means that he loves an inner air, an inner light in which freedom lives, and in which a man can draw the breath of self-respect." What does that mean to you? How optimistic are you about where we are now, 2021? You're a smiling, pretty positive guy.
Well, I got to tell you, that's not what we. I learned that's not everywhere in the world. And that wasn't the world it was. That wasn't the world behind the Iron Curtain. That's not the world it was in other parts of the world for people, black people in South Africa, black people in this country for too long. I think the idea of feeling free and feeling free about your life. And when your decisions you make are going to be your decisions, effectively your decisions, that they're going to matter, is a wonderful feeling. And not everybody felt it in this world. And I hope we keep it. I worry about the fact that a general talks about a military coup, supporting a military overthrow of our elected government. I worry that 3 out of 10 Republicans, and there's nothing wrong with being a Republican, of course, but if 3 out of 10 believe there's going to be a reinstatement of Donald Trump this August, that's zany. That's zany to start talking like that. There's nothing in our Constitution about, or even the word reinstatement. Where did that come from? Are people so docile, so accepting of dictatorial statements that are not true? That worries me. We went to war in Iraq because a president of limited ability, really, in history, was able to convince us to go to war. And a vice president wanted us to go to war in the worst way, and we did. Why? 4,000 or 5,000 people dead on our side, 200,000 on the other side of Iraqis, because we went in there with guns and said, if you don't do what we tell you to do, we're going to kill you, which is basically what we did to another country. How did this happen in this new century? I know that the past is prologue, and it worries me that this is a prologue to something new and menacing. I worry about it. I'm hoping there are enough people like Joe Biden and people like him, who are just regular Americans, who are willing to stand up against it.
Chris Matthews, words of wisdom and huge insight, which I am very grateful. And I think people will be thrilled. And the book is beautiful, This Country, My Life in Politics and History. And it's just a real pleasure to talk to you. I thank you.
It's great to go on a show that loves music. Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.